is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyus Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
No one is safe until everyone is safe. I therefore challenge all of us in our respective communities to accept the vaccination program and to shun vaccine hesitancy, misinformation, and the negative conspiracy theories. Getting vaccinated is a personal and a family responsibility, as well as a national obligation.
That was President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who launched the second phase of Zimbabwe's vaccination campaign by receiving a jab and encouraging people to shun misinformation and conspiracy theories. Details coming up also. U.S. and its Western allies welcome Libya's new government, headed by Abdullah Hamid Dabiba. And a cargo ship is blocking the Suez Canal. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A skyscraper-sized cargo ship is blocking the Suez Canal. The Ever Given, a Panama-flagged cargo ship, ran aground Tuesday in the narrow man-made canal dividing continental Africa from the Sinai Peninsula. The ship's Japanese owner offered a written apology today, saying his company is working hard to resolve the situation as soon as possible. Despite all the work so far to free the cargo ship, satellite photos taken today and analyzed by the Associated Press showed it's still stuck in the same location. A Dutch firm specializing in salvaging ships arrived at the canal today and warned that removing the vessel could take days to weeks. Following the formation of Libya's unity government, the United States joined its Western allies in welcoming the cabinet chosen by Prime Minister-designate Abdulhamid Dabiba. The joint statement applauded the Libyan people for their determination to restore unity to their country. The U.S. pledged to continue to support them and the U.N. efforts through the Berlin process. Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi how could the U.S. help bolster the new order in Libya.
Nevertheless, I would say they could really help even just by using their political weight and political means. They could, and they are already, providing political support to the government of national unity. They could and should contribute more to the negotiations about the consolidation of the ceasefire, especially about the implementation of a civilian UN monitoring mission, an efficient civilian UN monitoring mission to supervise the ceasefire. With regard to the withdrawal of foreign forces, you're right, they don't have much leverage in Moscow, but they could use an indirect approach. As I've just indicated, the presence of the Russians is tied to the presence of Turkey. So Washington could exert leverage on Turkey and on the Emirates. If the U.S. forces or convinces Turkey to withdraw its mercenaries and forces, regular forces, from Libya, the UAE could probably convince, probably they would stop paying the Russians. And this would mean that they would also need to withdraw. I doubt that Putin would be willing or that he is able for political reasons to pay a mercenary force abroad. All the other Wagner mercenaries, which are currently employed somewhere in Africa, are not paid by the Russian government. With regard to Turkey, keeping the dire Turkish economic situation in mind and keeping the costs for the deployment of forces to Libya in mind, I think there are some chances here to convince Erdogan to withdraw, if Turkey is able to continue to pursue its economic interests in Libya.
Can the U.S. push Turkey, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates to stop shipping weapons into Libya while helping Mr. Dabiba restore services, fight the coronavirus pandemic, and make preparations for the promised elections in December?
This is very unlikely. I would say almost no way. But if the ceasefire is consolidated, this would be some kind of insurance for Dabiba while dealing with the other pressing issues you've mentioned. But let me be clear, restoring services, especially in the greater Tripoli area, dealing with the day-long blackouts, fighting the pandemic and preparations for the elections are not blocked by the Libyan National Army or by Russian mercenaries. This is more about the still chaotic administration in Libya. This is about the numerous militias, about corruption, about the lack of consensus and many other things. So if the security on the security side, the situation is more or less stabilized, the Baber would have some room to maneuver.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. President Emmerson Mnangagwa has launched the second phase of Zimbabwe vaccination campaign by receiving a jab and encouraging members of the public to follow his example. Reporter Kudzani Musenge brings us more.
Mnangagwa was inoculated Wednesday with China's Sinovac vaccine in the resort town of Victoria Falls. He urged Zimbabweans to shun misinformation and conspiracy theories against COVID vaccines. Mnangagwa said being vaccinated enables individuals to contribute to the nation's role in the global fight against the coronavirus.
Let me reiterate the global call by the World Health Organization that no one is safe until everyone is safe. I therefore challenge all of us in our respective communities to accept the vaccination program and to shun vaccine hesitancy, misinformation, and the negative conspiracy theories. Getting vaccinated is a personal and a family responsibility, as well as a national obligation.
Mnangagwa commended frontline workers for being the first to be vaccinated in February. He said the availability of a vaccine should not make people drop their guard despite Zimbabwe's low infection rates and death toll.
Let us remain vigilant. Notwithstanding the availability of vaccines, I exhort all of us to continue adhering to the said COVID-19 World Health Organization guidelines and protocols, as well as our national lockdown measures.
Vice President and Health Minister Constantino Chiwenga said the government decided to launch the second phase of the vaccination campaign in Victoria Falls, the country's prime destination, to boost the tourism industry, saying distribution of the vaccine to locals would help reassure international tourists that the country is safe. Zimbabwe is among the lowest official case rate in the region, but some health experts remain worried that the figures do not reflect reality. Physician and former health minister, Dr. Henry Madzurira, says the country needs to ramp up COVID-19 testing.
Our figures are much lower than the figures in neighboring states. One of the major reasons is we've not been testing adequately. Even people with clinical symptoms of disease were not tested because of the cost of testing and because government was not providing free testing.
Madzurira also says citizens have been skeptical about the government's strategy in handling the pandemic and the vaccination program. Dr. Nomen Matara of the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights agrees, saying health experts should be at the forefront in the fight against the pandemic.
We need to let people who are specialists in the field of medicine and public health lead the way in pronouncing interventions that we need to do as a country, so that people have trust in those people and they can have a buy-in in terms of the interventions that we pronounce as a nation.
Zimbabwe has so far received a donation of 400,000 of Sinopharm doses from China and says it has purchased another 1.2 million. Reporting for VOA from Victoria Falls, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
South Africa's Constitutional Court is hearing a case today that could have far-reaching consequences for rule of law in the country. A commission of inquiry into corruption that happened during former President Jacob Zuma's tenure is asking the court to sentence him to jail. This because Zuma is refusing to testify at the inquiry about allegations that he orchestrated the plunder of state enterprises when he was president between 2009 and 2018. Darren Taylor has more.
Zuma says he won't take the witness stand because commission leader Judge Raymond Zondo is biased against him. The former president also refused to send lawyers to defend him at the Constitutional Court hearing. Given all this, says law expert Pierre DeVos. It seems as if this is an open and shut case.
I think that it is pretty certain that he will be found in contempt of court, given also that he had actually made statements that he wants to be in contempt of court. What the sentence will be, I think, is the real issue.
DeVos thinks the court could decide to make a final attempt to convince Zuma to publicly answer the commission's questions.
In which case court might impose a suspended sentence saying that you will go to prison unless in the next 3 weeks you go and testify before the State Capture Commission. That's one option. Another option is just incarceration. That is what the commission is arguing for in their papers. Or you can have a fine and additional suspended prison sentence. So I think maybe...
He says should Zuma escape by simply paying a fine, the implications for rule of law in South Africa would be terrible.
If there's legal proceedings and you just ignore the law, if there's court orders and you just ignore the court orders, it might invite other people who are maybe not as high status as you in society to do the same. As we have seen, one person has already declined to testify before the Zondo Commission, citing the former president's action. So...
DeVos says Zuma's being selfish and not thinking or not caring about what the consequences of his defiance could be for his nation.
The whole judicial system, in a way, works on legitimacy and it works on trust. There's a famous quote by the former Chief Justice Mohammed, who pointed out that courts do not have the power to impose taxes, they don't have a police force, they don't have an army. They are obeyed because we accept that the system is what it is, even if we don't agree with a specific judgment, we can appeal it.
Political analysts say just about Zuma's entire life, from when he was a liberation fighter to when he was president, has been based on undermining the law of the day.
What's happening here is that the former president has said, because I don't agree with the rulings you made against me, I don't want to testify because if I testify, I might incriminate myself and I might be sent to jail. If you do that, you are sending a signal that the whole system, if you're powerful enough, if you have enough money, you can just ignore all the rules, unlike everybody else. So you are asking...
Zuma's lawyers say he'll comment after the court makes a decision. Legal experts say this is a game of who'll blink first. Zuma's convinced the court won't jail him because he's too big for this and still has immense influence in the ruling African National Congress. It's actually a win-win situation for Zuma, they say. If he gets off lightly and doesn't testify, he beats the system once again. If he's jailed, his many supporters will regard him as a martyr, and the political power he holds will swell further. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South African businesses have to spend several hours per day without electricity as a result of power cuts that continue to plague the country. The impact has been particularly huge on small businesses that are struggling to recover from the impact of COVID-19 shutdown restrictions. Tuso Malo reports from Johannesburg.
For many small businesses in South Africa, power cuts have become the second pandemic threatening their existence. Amanda Lagreen owns a restaurant and coffee shop along the busy 7th Street of Johannesburg's Melville District. Power outages of 2 to 4 hours, sometimes 3 times a week, have become a real threat to her business.
For small businesses, the impact is huge. Our team have difficulties getting to work. Taxis are held up because the impact is on the road. The stores are impacted from, you know, anything that is refrigerated, so we have spoilage.
Audrey Kuboni operates a bookshop on the same street. She says once power cuts occur, people no longer visit the shopping center and her business also suffers.
You tend to lose a lot of money when there's no power because no one tends to come out when there's no power, electricity. So whether it's coffee shops and everything, and we do rely on people going to coffee shops because we are a small retail.
Power cuts are unpredictable and fluctuate in intensity. Recently, the state-operated power utility Eskom announced that 6,052 megawatts had been taken off the grid because of plant maintenance. During the same period, the grid also lost 12,690 megawatts due to breakdown and delays. Tom Stewart from Lulaland, a company that provides support to small businesses, says such power shortages are destructive to them.
It gives rise to unexpected costs, perishable goods spoiling, the need to purchase generators, etc. These are businesses that don't have deep cash reserves, so anything that impacts and eats into their cash savings or cash flow has a very detrimental impact on them.
Eskom recently announced a 15% hike in tariffs, but some energy experts say that is not sustainable to many businesses, especially the smaller ones. Energy expert Hilton Trollope says unless Eskom tackles the problem of its aging plants and corruption, the persistent power cuts will sink many small businesses and the economy at large.
These power stations were built 35, 40 years ago. They're reaching the end of their lifespan and they need to be replaced. They were also hammered quite hard over the past 12 years with load shedding.
The Department of Mineral Resources and Energy recently announced the appointment of 8 independent bidders to produce close to 2,000 megawatts of independent power, but it's not expected to come online until August next year, meaning power cuts are expected to continue in the meanwhile. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Long lines are showing up at COVID-19 vaccination centers in Malawi as people seek shots of the AstraZeneca vaccine, despite worldwide concerns about its side effects, safety, and efficacy. Government authorities say the overwhelming response is due to a massive sensitization campaign to diffuse fears about the vaccine. Ministry of Health authorities say the huge turnout has forced the government to consider hiring more medical staff and open more vaccination centers. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi started the COVID-19 vaccination last week after it received its first 360,000 doses. This is the first tranche of about 1.5 million doses of Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine through the International COVAX facility. The Minister of Health said yesterday that the country has so far vaccinated over 50,000 people. Kumbize Kandolo-Chipunda is Malawi's Minister of Health. She says the huge turnout is a sign of confidence Malawians have in the AstraZeneca vaccine.
You remember there's a lot of negative propaganda against this vaccine. But since we launched, and indeed our president, Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, was the first one to get the vaccine. And a few faith leaders, as well as some prominent politicians, including former president, they have received the same vaccine. So it has given confidence to the people of Malawi.
In the current first phase of vaccination, Malawi has identified priority groups, including teachers, healthcare workers, government security officers, the elderly, and people with underlying conditions. However, vaccination centers are characterized by long queues, and some people are rejected for failing to meet the requirements. The Minister of Health has asked people not to panic, saying it has adequate vaccine for everyone who needs it. Kandolo Chipunda also says the government will soon hire additional medical workers to help carry out the vaccinations.
As government, now that the pressure is increasing, we'll be increasing the number of vaccination centers, especially in cities like Blantyre, Lilongwe, Zuzu, and indeed Zomba as well.
The overwhelming queues come despite widespread concerns over AstraZeneca's efficacy and side effects. Several European countries briefly halted their rollouts of the vaccine after some recipients were diagnosed with a condition that causes blood to clot. However, medical workers in Malawi say they have not yet diagnosed anyone with side effects from the AstraZeneca vaccine. Last week, France, Germany, and Italy resumed the use of the vaccine. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Kenyan authorities have ordered the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, to make plans to close two refugee camps that are home to more than 400,000 refugees, mainly Somalis and South Sudanese. While it is not the first time Kenya has threatened to close the camps, rights groups say the order could endanger refugee lives. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
20-year-old Shadrach Nishimwe, a Burundian living in the Kakuma refugee camp in northern Kenya, fears for his future as the host nation threatens to close the camp.
Hii kambi ikifungwa, kitu naweza poteza ni amani, pia masomo.
If this camp is closed, he says, I can lose the peace and education I have here. If I go back home, there is no peace. He adds, if I go back, I will be admitted to a lower grade. Forget about the education system. I'm not sure I'll be able to continue with my studies. On Wednesday, Kenya ordered the closure of Kakuma and Dadaab refugee camps, home to at least 400,000 refugees, the majority of them Somalis. The East African nation gave the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, 2 weeks to develop a plan to close the camp. It is not the first time Kenya has threatened to close the Dadaab refugee camp. In 2016, Kenya wanted to close the camp in the northeast of the country for security reasons. It believes the camp is used by the Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab to plan and carry out attacks. The plan was blocked by Kenya's High Court, which termed it unconstitutional. Abdullahi Osman, a Somali national, is one of the refugee leaders in the Dadaab camp. He says it is too dangerous for him to go home. He says it is not possible to go back to Somalia. He says if the Kenyan government wants to take us by force, that's something else. But if we are asked to give our view, there's no safe place to go in Somalia. Many places in Somalia are insecure and there are killings. Otisieno Namwaya is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch. He says returning refugees to volatile countries is a dangerous affair.
What you should note is that the reasons for which the refugees left their countries are still there. The situation in Somalia has not stabilized. A few refugees from South Sudan who are in the camps, the places where they came from, the situation has not improved. And Burundi and many others. So for Kenya to come up right now and say they want to take them back, I think that is in violation of its obligations.
In a statement Wednesday, the UNHCR said the move will negatively impact refugees' lives, especially coming at the time of the COVID-19 pandemic. Attempts to reach the Kenyan Interior Ministry, which is in charge of refugee issues, were unsuccessful. Relations between Kenya and Somalia have been on the decline in recent years, with Mogadishu accusing Nairobi of interfering with its internal affairs. Kenya denies that allegation. Kenya has been hosting large numbers of Somali refugees since 1991, when Somalia's central government collapsed and the country descended into civil war. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehigis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.